It's early 1942, and the Nazis are racing to build an atomic bomb. They have the scientist, they have the will. What they don't have is enough heavy water, an essential ingredient needed to build Hitler's wonder weapon. And clearly, such a next-generation weapon is needed. As the USSR, under Stalin, has failed to collapse in on itself at the end of 1941, as Der Führer had famously predicted. And now the industrial might of the United States is officially an Allied partner. And now the Allies are working on their own wonder weapon and are on the same path as the Nazi scientists. The race is on to see who can create the first atomic bomb. While the Americans, with British help, are struggling to be the first, Britain must make sure the German effort is hampered, as London would surely be the first to feel the effects of a Nazi success. However, the Nazis' Achilles heel is the Norwegian plant Norsk Hydro's Vemork, which is the only entity in the world producing the heavy water. It's currently in Nazi hands, but the process is slow. Which brings us to our guest. With us today is Neil Bascom, the author of Hunting Eichmann, How a Band of Survivors and a Young Spy Agency Chased Down the World's Most Notorious Nazi, to discuss his latest book, The Winter Fortress, The Epic Mission to Sabotage Hitler's Atomic Bomb. Thank you, Mr. Bascom, for being with us.
Now, it's wonderful to be here.
All right. So I just finished your book. It was a very riveting read. I had read Hunting Eichmann. I enjoyed that as well, but I'm looking forward to everybody else getting their hands on this this book we're about to talk about. And when does The Winter Fortress come out?
The Winter Fortress publishes May 3rd.
Okay,
this year.
Okay, excellent. So how about we just jump into this? So both sides are trying to develop the next generation, if you will, of bombs to get that advantage because the war has been going on and both sides need it to end. If you could just give us an idea of what both sides are trying to do, what the significance of their accomplishments would be, the significance of heavy water. And as you do that, just please keep in mind that my scientific background consists of nothing more than Bill Nye, the science guy, and the Big Bang Theory, okay?
Fantastic.
All right.
So let's sort of bring it back a little bit to 1939.
Okay.
The discovery of the splitting of the atom. Mm-hmm. Now, for a very long time in physics circles, people had known that if they could somehow unlock the power of the atom, the sort of binding power of the atom, they would have a tremendous resource at their hands. They didn't know if it was possible. But in 1939, right before World War II, a German chemist and his assistant discovered that, in fact, you could split an atom and that they had done it. Now, at that moment, in Germany and in the United States, scientists and physicists came to the same very clear conclusion. Mm-hmm. They needed to be the first to harness the power of the atom, harness the power of the splitting of the atom for the purposes, a twofold purpose. One, power, potentially to power submarines or various other engines. But secondly, and perhaps most importantly, they wanted to create a bomb, a super explosive, something the world had never seen before.
Right.
And so you have, by the start of 1940, German scientists, some closely associated with the German army. In fact, the leader of the science for the Germans in atomic weapons was an officer in the German army. And simultaneously in the United States and in Britain, scientists are doing intensive early research into how do we split the atom further? How do we foster a chain reaction? How do we create an atomic bomb?
Right.
And very early in 1940 and then moving into 1941, most of the scientists come to the conclusion that they can do that one of two ways. They can create an explosive by either enriching uranium, meaning sort of make it very pure, because the explosive part of uranium comes in a very small part to the more common uranium. Or they could build a reactor. And this reactor would foster a chain reaction that would be under control, that chain reaction would, and I know I'm maybe stretching the science here, but stay with me.
Sure.
That reactor could create, as part of its process, plutonium.
Mm-hmm.
And that plutonium is the explosive ingredient that they would use for a bomb. Now, the Germans decided that in order to create or in order to build this nuclear reactor, they needed something called a moderator, something to help promote the splitting of atoms into a chain reaction.
Right.
And the ingredient that they chose for that was something called heavy water. Now, very simply, heavy water is based on an isotope or a variant of regular hydrogen. It has an extra neutron, which makes it heavier. And this heavy water has the property of both slowing down bombarding neutrons that cause atoms to split without absorbing them and stealing them from being able to split other atoms.
Okay.
And so this is heavy water. This is the importance of heavy water. And there's a single plant in the whole world in 1942 that produces heavy water at any scale, and that heavy water plant is in Norway.
That's amazing. So, and I remember reading at first, they had really had a trouble justifying it financially. Nobody was ordering large amounts of heavy water. You know, what were they going to do with it? So they couldn't produce a lot. So by the time Germany comes, they want the entire program stepped up. And they're like, you know, we can only do so much so fast. But Germany is taking this very seriously. And they do whatever they can to increase the production of heavy water.
Correct. And, you know, it's a very interesting story. This plant in Norway called Vermoek, which was owned by a big Norwegian industrial firm, Norsk Hydro. And heavy water is discovered in the early 30s. And this scientist, chemist named Leif Tronstad, Norwegian professor who also consults for all these industrial concerns in Norway, sort of rising star of the Norwegian scientific establishment. He says, well, you know, in order to produce heavy water, you need a lot of power and you need a lot of water. And there's one place in all of Norway that has that, this Vermoek hydroelectric plant. And Tronstad doesn't know what people are going to use heavy water for. He thinks maybe for cancer research. He knows maybe for atomic research. He thinks some people joke that it'll build a better skating rink. He doesn't actually care what it's for. He just he's a scientist, and he wants to see if it can be done.
Gotcha.
And so he does. He builds this process. It is enormously successful in producing heavy water, but it's a financial disaster for Norsk Hydro. They shutter it until the fissioning of the atom, and suddenly it's booming business.
So it's suddenly such a beyond price commodity. So when the Nazi Germany invades Norway in April of...
they'd occupy in the spring of 1940.
Okay, I'm sorry. That's right. I'm getting my month right, year wrong. Sorry.
That's about all right.
Yeah. I guess the ironic thing is, as far as I could tell in your book, it wasn't the number one reason Hitler invaded Norway had nothing to do with heavy water, as far as I could tell. It seemed to just be a race between Hitler and Churchill. Who could get there first?
Absolutely. I mean, as I describe it in the book, and maybe in an early version of a draft, it's, you know, Norway at a certain point was a ball of yarn that two cats were trying to paw around.
Right.
And the British wanted it, and the Germans wanted it, largely for the coast. The control of the coast and the waters, and heavy water again. They wanted it, but it was by no means in the military plans. That said, when Germany invaded Norway, the Germans made very sure that they took control of Vermoek very quickly.
Gosh.
And began. They increased production by tenfold within the matter of a small window of time.
Wow. Okay. So both sides are trying to achieve the same thing. And for London, I find this really interesting. For London, the fighting with Germany, Nazi Germany, has gotten personal. I mean, they refuse to get out of it. They're bombing each other. And London's got to know that if the Germans come up with any form of this bomb, they're probably going to be the first ones to realize it. So London very quickly has to get the United States, you know, once Pearl Harbor comes, they have to get the United States involved. And I think even though it was a very short conversation between FDR and Churchill, it's pretty much decided to do the work in the United States where it's relatively safe, but Britain is going to contribute whatever they can to this process. But basically the race is on at this point.
No, the race is absolutely on. By 1942, it's very clear. And in fact, in propaganda films that reached the Allies that the Germans created, there were, you know, maps of London and huge explosions basically obliterating it.
Wow.
So I don't think the Allies had any misconception that Hitler wanted to obliterate, bomb into dust, whatever he could in terms of London. So yes, the race is on by 1942. And by the start of 1942, they're pretty much neck and neck. The Germans have done the preliminary research, the preliminary theoretical work. They secured uranium and began to secure enough heavy water. And simultaneously in the United States, they've done the basic research. They have what they need. And now it's let's move forward.
Wow. Okay. So the race is on. So I guess for the British, okay, America, we're going to give you everything we can. I hope you get this bomb created as soon as you possibly can. But even that's not good enough. They have to do whatever they can, given their proximity, to slow down or stop the Germans. And so clearly some kind of plan is needed. They've got to do something to throw a monkey wrench into the works at Vermuk.
Yes, and this is the case. And there actually were high-level discussions in Churchill's administration as well as Roosevelt's administration. There's two ways to win the race. You're the first one to do it. B, you hobble your opponent. Hobble your opponent was on the minds of the Americans as well as the British. And here's the thing. They need one thing. They really didn't know much about the German atomic bomb program.
Mm-hmm.
But thanks to an individual named Leif Tronstadt, who actually built the heavy water plant, and he, after the Germans occupied Norway, he went underground. He began basically becoming a spy and delivering intelligence to the Allies of the German interest in heavy water at Vermuk. And so the Allies knew that heavy water was a key ingredient to the German atomic research program. And it was really the only thing they knew about the atomic research program. And so they very deliberately said, we need to do everything we can to stop this plant from producing anything more. And the initial idea from both the Americans and the British, as early as December 1941, but gathering steam in early 1942 was, we're just going to bomb this plant from the air.
Right. But Tronstadt, who obviously can tell him about it inside and out. Now, I can't remember exactly when he comes over to London, but he can only do so much for his country as a resistance, either fighter or gathering intelligence, because what he has to offer as a scientist is so much more if he can get over there. So he seems to be crucial, saying, no, you don't want a bomb, and here's why.
Exactly. I mean, Tronstadt's one of my favorite individuals in the course of the story, and he's in many ways its hero, beyond the actual saboteurs themselves, the commandos. He was a different hero, but so he in the fall of 1941, the Gestapo learns that he's been providing information. They descend on his house. He escapes an hour before that. He leaves his wife and two children safely with some relatives. And he skis and hikes and his way across the Swedish border, takes a plane to London, arrives in London. They say, you should work in the scientific establishment to help our military science. And he says, no, I want to find a way to fight more directly for my country.
Right.
And so he joins the Norwegian, exiled Norwegian High Command Army. And suddenly, not suddenly, but over the course of months, finds himself sort of at the nexus of Norwegian High Command Army and a British SOE, Special Operations Executive, the commando operations of the British.
So as angry as he is, as much as he wants to go back over there with some help and fight the Germans, that's not his best way to contribute. So he's able to take his knowledge and explain to the British. And if you could give us an idea of what was his point of view as far as not bombing? Why shouldn't the British just go over there with a bunch of planes and just bomb the heck out of the facility? Wouldn't that take care of everything?
Yes. So Tronstadt says, you can bomb it, but here's what's going to happen. One, you're going to kill a lot of civilians because Vermok is by this town named Rukan, which has 5,000 inhabitants, all who work at the plant or the surrounding plant, innocent civilians. So you're going to kill them. And secondly, you're going to kill them, and you're not going to destroy the plant because it is, as the title of my book goes, a winter fortress. It's this enormous steel and stone and glass building, and the heavy water facility is in the basement. So over 10,000 pounds of, tens of thousands of pounds of steel and stone, you can bomb it from the air all day, and you're still not going to touch the plant. Right.
So it might make the British feel better, but it's not going to achieve what the objective is as far as slowing down the Germans. So I guess eventually they either listen to him or whatever, but they decide, yes, we need to sabotage this as opposed to blowing it up, as opposed to bombing it. But first, we got to get some eyes on the ground, some boots on the ground. Can you tell us a little bit about, if I haven't skipped anything, please let me know if I have, but tell us a little about the Grouse team or the Grouse operation?
Sure. So now, if it was up to Leif Tronstadt, he would have parachuted single-handedly into Norway and gone and attacked the plant itself. Because, I mean, that's how gung-ho he was.
Right.
But the British are like, well, you're too big of a brain and you're too effective here. We need you here. But so he begins to operationally plan this. And from Norway comes over this young man named Einar Schinnerlund, who's a dam supervisor at the hydroelectric dam and around the plant. And he had come over to fight like many other young Norwegians, had escaped by boat. He actually hijacked a boat, got to England, said, I want to be trained to fight. And Leif Tronstadt says, well, you actually live right at this plant. And not only you live there, but your family works there and you work there and you know everyone in the area.
Right.
Here's what you're going to do. You're going to take a week. You're going to learn how to parachute and we're going to drop you back. And so everyone is going to think you just went on a skiing vacation. And so poor Einar Schinnerlund, who's actually has just had surgery on his leg from a skiing accident, gets this rudimentary training and is parachuted back into the ground. And he is the central point of intelligence now for the ongoing operations. And so the British decide, okay, here we go. We need an operation. We're going to send some Royal Engineers, about 35 of them. Royal Engineer commandos, parachute commandos, to be dropped into the area, and they're going to go attack the plant. And Schinnerlund's providing all the intelligence on all the security and minefields and searchlights and guard patrols. But these sappers, these Royal Engineers, they need people to, for lack of a better word, be a welcome party.
Right.
Be on the ground to say, okay, put out lights for the planes and also to lead them, guide them to the plant. And so here comes Operation Grouse, which is a four-man team led by an individual named Jan Anton Paulsen, who is a member of what's called Company Ling, which is the SOE-trained Norwegian commando forces.
Okay.
And he is a local to the area, too. And he is dropped by parachute with his three compatriots in October of 1942 to be the spearhead of this British operation.
Okay, so far so good. The British have decided to sabotage, not bomb. They're going to send in their team to get everything ready, and they're going to train their sappers to go in there and blow it up. So far, everything's fine. But then I think it's somewhere around October of 1942, Hitler puts out the word that, you know, forget chivalry. All commandos, all special forces are to be killed. There's no time for mercy. We need these people eliminated. And if we do it cruelly enough, maybe they'll stop sending him over, because he, you know, as the leader of an army, he gets the value of what some, you know, a lot of damage that the commandos could cause. So he puts the word out, death to all of the commandos that you come across.
Correct. And this literally happened within a month's time of all the initial operations at Vermont. So these British commandos, these Norwegian commandos, they are suddenly, if they're captured, they won't be. They will be killed on site immediately. And so this is the sort of atmosphere in which they're working. So the British now plan this operation, and they sort of sideline Tronstadt at this point. I mean, he is basically becoming an information source, mm-hmm. but he's not the one making the decisions, not doing the ultimate planning. This is now a British Army engineered operation called Operation Freshman. Yeah. And they had all good intentions and very brave young sappers who were sadly put on a mission that probably didn't have much of a chance to succeed. Because the British decide that they need to bring in these troops silently together as a unit with gear. They decide that parachuting them in would be troublesome because they would be dispersed and who knows where they're going to land. So they're going to use gliders, engineless gliders that will be towed across the North Sea, released over the area. They would glide down softly into the snow, arguably, mm-hmm. and the mission would come off without a hitch.
Okay.
The problem is this is happening in the wintertime. The Vida, which is the area around Vermuk, is this rocky, mountainous plateau, which 1 mile looks exactly like the next. It's sort of like the moon. Right. And these gliders come across, they're released. One of the towing gliders, the Halifax, crashes into a mountain. Mm-hmm. The released glider crashes into a mountain. Another glider is the rope is severed because of ice. It crashes in the mountain, and the operation is just an unmitigated disaster.
Yeah, so again, the wrong time of the year, the cold, I guess maybe there's fog or clouds or whatever. And so what should have been a pretty sizable, experienced team of, as far as I can remember, British soldiers, suddenly there's a catastrophe. Most of the men are dead, and there are some that have survived, and they're going to be captured by the Germans. I'm trying to remember, I think some of them were killed right away, maybe per Hitler's orders, but then some of them were, was some of them saved and questioned later? Or questioned?
Yeah, so there was this commando order, right? And the commando order was kill immediately. Mm-hmm. Don't capture. And that was a German army order. But the Gestapo had a very different mandate, which was to capture people, interrogate them, torture them if need be, to find out what is the target and what is the method. So some of these soldiers who survived this crash in what was already called a wooden coffin, these gliders, those that weren't killed immediately by German soldiers, they were brought to Oslo, put in a detention center, tortured. And ultimately, at the end of the day, the Germans knew by November 1942 the target, how the sappers were going to attack it, pretty much everything, right, including the fact that there was men on the ground who were there to help, which launches a massive manhunt.
Right. So the Germans now pretty much have all the intelligence. You just have to assume they're going to beef up defense, which is going to make any future attempt that much harder. But could you give us an idea of the team that was in the field, you know, setting the lights for these guys? Because wasn't there, I don't know how to say his name. Is it Paulson? Paulson?
Paulson. Yeah, Paulson. Okay.
If you can give us a little
idea. That's right. I butcher them too.
Okay, good. I feel better now.
They're on hand. They're in the snow, sending out radio signals, waiting for these planes to come. They never come. They hear the engines, but the planes and the gliders never arrive.
Right.
They're told 3 days later, these planes have either crashed or the gliders, the people have been captured, and you need to run into the mountains.
Right.
So you have these four men who are commandos, who are also very good cross-country skiers, who are hunters, who know the terrain, who probably have the best chance of survival of anyone in the world to what they now have to face, which is several months of surviving in the Vita, a place that was, you know, legend had it grew so cold, so fast in blizzards that flames froze in the fire. I mean, it is just an awful place to be. In the wintertime, if you're not just out there for a little nice cross-country ski.
Right. I just have to tell you, I was reading that part of the book, and you first of all, through the entire book, you throw in everything, including the kitchen sink, and I just loved all the detail, so I wanted to thank you. But I'm sitting there reading about the skiing and the snow and the ice, and they're slipping, and they're getting wet, and they're frozen. And I'm reading this. It's 75 degrees weather where I live. I'm in shorts and a T-shirt, and I'm getting cold just thinking about these guys. I mean, that's how well you paint the picture. So you really get a sense of Norway would be nice on a postcard, but I certainly wouldn't want to go there during the winter. But I was struck, the other part was when the report finally gets to Churchill about the absolute unmitigated disaster, the deaths, just the way it was all cocked up. And he just writes, alas, on the report.
Yes. I mean, it's, you know, from our perspective now, as so many decades later, that seems very coarse and unfeeling.
Right.
But you have to imagine what Churchill and Roosevelt and Churchill, who, you know, experienced at least some parts of World War I and the just slaughter there. Mm-hmm. But now World War II is no party either. There are men dying in the thousands all over the place. And this was just, in some ways, another bad mark, and probably what was a long list of bad marks on any given day. Mm-hmm. So that said, within a day of Operation Freshman, the glider operation with the sappers going awry, the importance of the mission is so preeminent, right, that a new mission is launched called Operation Gunnerside.
Gotcha. So, yeah, and if it helps, when I was reading that part about Churchill, it certainly didn't come across as unfeeling. I mean, you could almost sense as like, you know, that's how it is, and there'll be more deaths, you know, after this. So I thought I really captured that moment well. So the men are told to go pretty much hide because they can only do this at certain times of the month, I guess. And so they're going to have to hide. The Germans are following them. But like you said, because this is so important, another team, Gunnerside, is starting to be put together, assembled, so they can rehearse and practice and get ready. Could you give us an idea of some of the players of Team Gunnerside?
Sure. But before I launch into that, I will say about these Grouse team members, the ones who have to survive. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a lot of this story that is very much about, you know, beating the Germans. But I think at its core, this story is, you know, these guys would not have been able to pull off these operations. Their main enemy in some ways was nature, was the Vita.
Right.
And that's what the Grouse faced. Now, Gunnerside is this operation that is led by a young man that is selected for it, a 23-year-old Norwegian second lieutenant. Named Joachim Ronenberg.
Wow.
And he had no military experience. in terms of actual battle experience. He had been, he had come over from Norway on a boat. He had been trained by the SOE and then became a trainer for the SOE. Mm-hmm. But he had never seen battle, never led men in the actual field of operations. And it was a remarkable, brave choice on the part of Tronstadt and his counterparts in the SOE to pick him.
Right.
But at the end of the day, it ended up being a brilliant choice. I mean, Runneberg was very strategic, very tactically good. He was calm. He was a good leader. He was just very effective in the field. And the question was, would he be able to maintain that when he was actually there?
Right. And be the leader of his team. So just to sum up, so the Allies realize what's going on. They realize the importance of the heavy water. They've had their first attempt, which went horribly wrong, but they start forming a second team right away. And I found it interesting that they said this time, no, we're going to go with Norwegians. We're going to put them in British uniforms. Could you tell us some of the significance of that, please?
So the significance of the British uniforms was if Norwegian commandos were caught in Norwegian uniforms sabotaging Vermok or any other place, there would be severe repercussions for the local Norwegian population. And because who knows where these Norwegians came from? Did they, they could be local boys, they could be whatever. And so they decided that the Tronstadt and the British decided whoever goes in is going to be a British uniform. But they decided only Norwegians can pull this off. Only people who know the terrain, only people who were in some ways literally born with cross-country skis on their feet could reach the plant and not only reach the plant, but escape once the operation is over. And so this gunner side operation has grouse on the ground waiting for them, who are all local boys. Mm-hmm. And they have these six team members from gunner side who are trained in blowing up the heavy water plant and are expert commandos. And then there's Schinnerland, who's still on the ground in hiding around Vermok, continuing to provide intelligence as well as assistance to the whole team.
Okay. So this entire time, the Germans are doing everything they can to increase production of heavy water, get it back to Germany as quickly as they can to keep their experiments going. Now, so Team Grouse is going to be waiting for a while. I think there are at this point some reprisals against the locals for the attempt, for now that the Germans know that there are people on the ground. I'm going to get you to talk about that a little bit, but I just wanted to make very clear in this book, you do an excellent job of making the point that this is truly, in some ways, a story about men, about humans versus nature. You go into great detail about what they had to do to survive, the hunger, the lack of vitamins, what it was doing to their body, their cold, they're just trying to survive, and also not to go insane over the months that, weeks and months that they're going to have to survive all this. But I could not pass this part without Paulson shooting the deer. He's absolutely starving. He's excited that he's going to bring some meat back to his men. But to keep up his strength, I guess, he actually drinks some of the reindeer blood right there before he starts cutting into his kill.
Yes, I mean, at a certain point in this story, when these Grouse team members are on the Vita, again, this high plateau with no other food. I mean, it is frozen tundra, mm-hmm. and the only food is reindeer. The only way to survive is killing a reindeer. And every day Paulson goes out on a hunt, his team is getting weaker and weaker and weaker. He needs to get a reindeer. On December 23rd, 1942, fateful because that was the day he finally found a reindeer, tracked a herd, killed one, and then pretty much from that point forward, these men celebrate a wonderful Christmas with reindeer steaks, but begin to consume only reindeer. And when I say only reindeer, I mean every part of the reindeer, except for the hooves and I think some cartilage in the ear that they could not consume, but pretty much everything else. and not to gross out your listeners, but mm-hmm. I think it's sort of emblematic of this. You know, they needed nutrients. They needed, not just the meat, but they needed nutrients. And the one way they could find that was eating the moss, the half-digested moss that the reindeer carried in their stomach. Wow. I mean, this is the sort of level of survival intensity we're dealing with over the course of this story for these guys. And I think it's not just the sort of survival physically. And I think to your point, what I loved about this part of the narrative. Because we often look at history like from hindsight and gosh, it's really good that these guys did this and yes, they succeeded and there was no doubt that they would succeed. But after, 2.5 months of living out there in the wild in a small cabin surrounded by snow and barely surviving, mm-hmm. Paulson and his team, they began to, fray. And began to lose hope. And it took everything that they could do to muster to fight back the thoughts that they were having, which were, is this worth it?
Yeah.
Are we going to succeed? I don't think we're going to succeed. This is all for naught. These are the thoughts that they had. They persevered. But I think it's not being accurate to history not to look at those moments. I think those moments are important.
Yeah, absolutely. With hindsight, they struggle, but I know they're going to make it, so I'm not going to get worked up about it. But yeah, if you've gotten to the point, if you could put yourself in that moment, I mean, they probably couldn't remember anything other than snow, chasing after reindeer and tundra. And I just imagine if you had told a German soldier, look, I got these guys drinking reindeer blood, eating half-chewed moss. That's what they're willing to do to stay in here and try to defeat you. I mean, I would think that would give some of the occupiers pause, but they are literally staying in there. But like you were saying earlier, emotionally, they are starting to crack from the strain. And I love the part in the book when because their waiting is going to go on for months. And early 1943, when they just start literally, so they don't go insane, they each take turns almost like holding court, lecturing on various subjects that they knew about, or maybe they spoke about their previous jobs, but just anything to deal with the monotony and the time, just night after night of just waiting until another opportunity could come to strike at the plant.
Yes, I mean, I too, sort of is. So it's just a real moment, to have these guys, for instance, Arne Schellstrup, telling these guys basically how toilets work or, how to plumb a line. I mean, just so there's, what you also have to sort of be aware of is it's light like 5 hours a day.
Yes. Oh my God.
Okay. And they can't waste fuel on light. So they are essentially in this one-room cabin, in the dark, alone for hundreds of days, over 100 days. Living with one person is sometimes hard enough. living with three in the confined space of a shed where none of you have showered or shaved and you're starving and you're cold and there's hoarfrost growing on the walls. And you can't step outside without, binding yourself up. I mean, it's tough going.
Yeah. So they're sitting there waiting for the opportunity. Now the next team, Gunner's side is still getting ready. They're practicing, but I'm probably going to butcher his name, Ronenberg, who's going to be in charge. Can you give us an idea of some of the stuff that he was doing to get prepared, knowing the elements and the conditions that he and his men were going to be getting into?
So Ronenberg was a very meticulous man, meticulous planner. And he, of course, knew what this weather was like. He knew that they needed to potentially survive for a while in this cold, and they need to escape. And, you know, they can't just, charter a flight out of there. They're going to have to escape hundreds of miles on cross-country skis to the border of Sweden to get free afterwards. Mm-hmm. And so he begins preparing, sleeping bags. There are no sleeping bags in London at this point that can weather the Norwegian winter. So mm-hmm. he designs and sketches out and goes to a bedding manufacturer and designs his own sleeping bags for his men.
Right.
They design sleds. They particular boots. They go to a Norwegian professor and assemble rations that had never been used before in the field. Mm. These Kryberg rations. And so not only are they doing that to prepare, but they are, with Leif Tronstadt, practicing day after day on a mock wooden plant of the heavy water facility in order that they know every nook and cranny of this plant. And then they go in, they're going to be able to do it.
Right. So they're practicing, they're getting ready. They could do this probably in their sleep now because they've done it on the model so much, but they still have to get over there. So there are storms, they make an attempted drop, which doesn't work. But I think mid-February, finally, Gunnerside is able to go in and this time wisely not use the gliders, but just parachute in and deal with that as best they could.
So, yes, it's just an assembly of disasters prior to that that we don't need to go into. But, you know, one time they had to come back and drop all their equipment out and almost crash land. Another time their plane was eaten up by a German anti-aircraft mm-hmm. shells. I mean, they barely made it. They finally get there mid-February. They're down on the ground. They're assembling all their equipment that they dropped with them. And the worst blizzard in 100 years hits.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, so
it's the kind of blizzard that if you're walking upright, the wind can literally pick you up and throw you off your feet. It's the kind of blizzard where day turns into night and you see nothing but white. And it just, for several days, they barely survived. You know, they found a cabin, they hunkered down. And when they woke up finally and the blizzard had quieted, the landscape was, something entirely different because of the drifts of snow and all the rest.
Wow. So I guess the good news is with that kind of weather, it's not like German patrols are going to be in the area looking for them. But again, they had, like you said, they had to survive Mother Nature. So the two teams get together, Gunnerside and Sparrow, and they're planning out their adventure. And I thought this was interesting. The leader decided to take a vote on how they would actually proceed against the plant and go in there and sabotage it, as opposed to just saying, I'm in charge, this is how I'm going to do it. I mean, he relied on these men's intelligence and their, because they had a keen desire to be there to do their part. And so everybody brought their best foot forward, and they actually were discussing and voting on how to proceed against this heavy water plant treatment area.
Yeah, I mean, again, this is a brilliant moment on the part of Ronenberg, the leader of the operation. You know, he had individuals who were much more experienced than he was. His second command, Nuke Alkalid, who is a wonderful character in this story, was American born and just a bit of a rascal. Ronenberg needed to make sure that everyone was on board. And listen, I mean, they thought that this operation was a suicide mission.
Right.
They thought that they could get in probably, but they weren't going to get out.
Yeah.
If they could, maybe one or two of them would have got out, but they would have been captured.
Right.
They were prepared to, they had suicide capsules, sewn into their lapels and elsewhere. So when Ronenberg was planning this, he wanted his men with him. It was a tough choice. Do we come down from the mountains above, but there's minefield? Do we cross the single lane suspension bridge that is super well guarded by the Germans, particularly since they knew from Operation Freshman that this was the entry point for the previous go? Or do they do the third method, which actually Tronstadt in London suggested, which was climb down the valley that Vermelk is in, cross a river, and then scale a 500-foot cliff. God. I mean, of three options, I'm not sure which one I would have taken other than being like, I'm going to go to Oslo and, have some aquavit.
Yeah. I'll wait for you later. Yeah, exactly. So they're in position. They decided how they're going to attack. And I'm just going to let you take it from here for all this planning, all the sacrifice, all those British sappers. They've lost men already. They're getting ready to go in. They're going to try and make a difference in this race to get the atomic bomb. If you could just sketch out for us the actual act of the sabotage, please.
Sure. So it's the night of February 27th, 28th, about 8 in the evening. They're at a cabin up in the opposite part of the valley. It's go time. Runenberg gives the sort of last-minute instructions to his men. And one of his last instructions is, someone has to make it. I don't care what you have to do, who does it, but one person has to make it into that plant and blow this thing up.
Right.
And that is the essence of what they're facing. So they ski down, and, I open the book in this sort of very poignant scene of these skiers going through these woods very quietly, because I imagined it very much that way, and that's how they told it, until they get down into the valley, at the bottom of the valley, and now they're looking up. And again, this is February, so it's extremely cold. It's very dark. And they're looking up at a 500-foot cliff. That's not a sheer cliff. It's sort of both a sheer cliff and a scramble.
Right.
But it's icebound, and it's dark, and they don't know what to hold on to. And as Runenberg said later in his life, he essentially felt like he was standing on a street in the middle of a metropolis, looking up at a huge skyscraper, and told, "That's where you got to go." And that said, they manage one helping the other, and one person almost falling, and a lot of bravery and a lot of exertion. They make it to the top of this cliffside, where there's a railway line perched on the edge of this cliff, and it's actually still there today, and it's, you just can't believe they did it. And it leads straight into the plant. And the Germans, I don't know how to say it, but I understand why they didn't guard it that much. no one would possibly conceive that anyone would do this. Not only in the middle of the day in a nice summer, but let alone at night in the cold in the middle of winter. But they manage to reach this railway line. They wait until the change in the guard after midnight. They cut through a gate with a pair of bolt cutters that they bought at a London mechanic shop, and they break in. There's a covering party led by Knut Haukelid, who's going to make sure that the guards don't interfere. Five men are in the covering party. There's four men who are on the demolition team. That demolition team is split into two-man teams. Runenberg's leading one. His old friend, Stromsheim, is leading the other. Mm-hmm. And they descend on the plant. They get to the door that they believe is supposed to be open, and it's locked. Thankfully, Leif Tronstadt gave them every bit of information that you could ever possibly want about this plant.
Right.
And there was a little tunnel that pipes and conduits ran through on the side of the building. They found themselves, coursing their way through that. They dropped down into the plant, and the operation to blow up is going off.
Yeah, because the tunnel, I thought, was going to have a railing or a net or a guard or something over it. But again, who would climb through that, crawl through that in this area? I mean, again, you can't blame the Germans too much for being a little lax in their security.
No, absolutely. And so Runenberg crawls through this tunnel with his seconds, and they drop down, and they're now in the basement of the heavy water plant.
Mm-hmm.
The sort of soft underbelly of Vermont, because the Germans never in their wildest imaginations thought anyone would actually get into the plant. And so there was one guard, a Norwegian night watchman, foreman, looking over the heavy water plant to make sure it was running okay. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, there was nobody there. Wow. And so they have, not all the time in the world, because they have five people outside covering them, but they have, you know, over the course of a half hour, time to set individual explosives that had already been pre-prepared, plastique, to blow up the 18 heavy water cylinders that purified the heavy water to 99.5%. So they set those, and in the middle of setting them, the window shattered, and it's the other demolition team who didn't find the tunnel and decided to break in another way. Together, they set the rest of the explosives. There's a moment where I love this moment in the story. It's the night watchman sort of stops them and knows what's happening here. Clearly, right. These people are going to blow this up, and you know, and he can't find his glasses. So, which is just this bizarre little, very human moment in this story, where he's like, I can't find my glasses. And so Ronenberg stops setting the explosives, stands away. He's searching around on the desk for this guy's for his glasses.
Right.
And eventually gives them to him, continues with the work, sets, and they set off the timers, and, or the fuses, and boom.
So yeah, so they get in there. They're able to set their charges just like they had rehearsed. They get out, and I think if I remember correctly, the foreman and someone else they might run across are like, okay, go over there and get as far away as you can. And I didn't think about this before, where they tell the guys to keep your mouth open, I guess, to help deal with the pressure once the explosion goes off.
Yes, they instructed them to run up the steps, keep your mouth open. In order that their eardrums weren't ruptured because of the pressure.
Right.
And so there, you know, you imagine this at night, there's this, you know, boom, this explosion. They've set up 18 packets of plastique. You would imagine this just eruption of flame and fire and this huge noise and this sturm and drong. And to Knut Haugland, who's the covering guy, all he hears is a little... a little muffled, silent, almost imperceptible concussion. And he's like, was that it? Is that what we came for? And it's just, again, it's just one of these moments because, you know, this heavy water plant, again, the reason we couldn't bomb it from the air is because it's in the basement of this fortress. And so an explosion is not what he thought. It was enough for a guard to come out and for Haukele to, you know, ready his attack on him.
Yeah, that part drove me crazy. The guard would go out, come back out of the guardhouse, go back in, come back out. He's like, did I hear something? But you're right, between the howling of the wind and the noise of the factory, you could barely hear, and I was expecting, like all the other guys, I was expecting this huge explosion, gas and concrete going all over the place. But again, it was in the basement. Their mission is accomplished, but now they've got to get out of there. And the Germans are going to be alerted, so it's going to be a massive hunt. So if you could just give us a little bit about their escape, please. Again, because they've got to deal with the cold, they've got to deal with the snow, and now they're being chased by some very upset Germans.
Yeah, so now is the beginning of the mass escape for these guys, and you know they get down the cliff again, and they cross the river, and then they a portion of them begin this long 200-mile escape, and there are others that are going to remain in the area, mm-hmm. so they can organize resistance cells around Vermelk.
Wow.
And so it's this, you know, there's this epic manhunt, thousands of troops descending on the area, Some of these guys go one way, some go the other way, and there's some tremendous escape stories. And what's great, I think, what I love about this book is I thought this, not about what a great job I did on the book, but this story,
right?
Is I had always heard of Operation Gunnerside, where these guys go into the plant, they blow it up. It's this very successful mission. And really, that's the midway point of my book.
Yes.
It's the halfway. For the listeners, I want to tell them everything, but I also want them to read the book.
Yeah. So, because I was going to say, okay, so they blow up the plant, the Germans never get another ounce of heavy water again, and everything is fine, which obviously is nowhere near to what happens. So we won't go to the very end, but the Germans, because they know how important this is, or I guess certain elements in Berlin, they know how important this is, so they are going to spare no expense into getting at least this part of the factory up and running again, and before too long, heavy water is coming out of the plant.
Yes, and the Allies know this, thanks to Schinnerlin, and several of these operatives, most notably Hauglid, remains in Norway in the area, building resistance cells, but also keeping a very close eye on Vermuk and ready to take action when the call comes. And it definitely comes.
Yeah. So we won't give the ending away, but just suffice it to say the Germans have got it back online. They are getting access to heavy water to keep their experiments going, because they are trying very hard, obviously. By the time 1943 comes, the Germans, I think, realize that they need something other than their conventional weapons. But here was the part, and again, this book has everything in it, every element in a story you could possibly have, where the Allies basically lie to Trotstad, and they don't mention anything about bombing to him. They don't even bring it up. They just say, yeah, we'll pitch the idea of not to do that. But then they do, and like you were saying earlier, a lot of civilians do get hurt, a lot of lives are ruined, and as Trotstad knew, it doesn't work. So the bombing was for nothing. Clearly, they have to do something other than bombing. They're going to have to go back in. They're going to have to do something. But that's when the Norwegians are able to step in and, again, do some very amazing things to try to stop the Germans from getting this critical element to, stop them from developing the atomic bomb.
Yes. And I think, I wouldn't call it controversy as much as sort of historical back and forth about, were the operations at Vermuk important?
Mm-hmm.
Because by the summer of 1942, while the Americans were racing ahead with the Manhattan Project, the Germans were saying, the war is not going great. We need whatever we're going to invest in. It's got to have pretty immediate payoff.
Mm-hmm.
And so some people sort of take that and say, well, heavy water, that became unimportant. But I couldn't disagree more, and not only because I wrote the book about it, because I've done the research on it.
Mm-hmm.
Kurt Diedner, who was the head of the German atomic bomb program, who was the one who wanted to build the bomb, mm-hmm. who wanted to build a bomb by creating a heavy water reactor to get plutonium to build an explosive. He was told very clearly, if you build a heavy water reactor, if you show us that this can be done, that power can be generated, that we can make this work, we will shower you with money. You will have every resource. And so the only way he could show that it worked was to have enough heavy water. He had enough uranium. He didn't have enough heavy water.
Right.
And so these activities, the Gunnerside, this continuing pressure from the Allies to bomb, and ultimately the sort of last minute sabotage by Hauglid, all was for purpose and had a reason. And even if it, let's argue it didn't, let's say that Kurt Diemer was never told that,
Right.
The Allies simply didn't know. As far as they could know, the Germans had it. They were close to a bomb. They needed to do everything in their power to stop it. So it makes these events, worthwhile, I think, from both perspectives.
Right, because like you've said before, we're looking at this at hindsight. We know both sides of the story. The Allies didn't know how far the Germans had gone, and they've got to be thinking, well, if we can develop this, why can't they develop it with their scientists? So clearly the race is on. But, yeah, you sprinkle Diebner, if I'm saying his name right, the German scientist, you sprinkle his story throughout it, and he's just getting closer, and he's struggling, and he's not giving up, and he's making deals. He's doing whatever he's going to do, and he's going to get something. And I think near the end of the story, maybe we can't get the atomic bomb, but maybe we could get some really nasty material. And I'm being very general there because I'm not sure. But to spread over London, I mean, they could have still, if they could have developed something, they could have made a lot of people.
They could have built a dirty bomb.
Yeah, exactly. They could have made a lot of lives miserable. So I was just sure that they were going to get to a point where here's a bomb, but then it's too late. But he does not stop, and that just really keeps the story going. So there is more to the story than what we've covered today. The there's more to the end, and actually, you take the story all the way to the end when the Germans have to pull out and they get their country back. But I just want to say on a personal note, and I'll certainly let you, if there's anything else you want to throw out, please feel free to do so. But since I've been doing this podcast for 5 years and I've read a ton of books, I think I can count on one hand the number of books that by the time I finished reading it, I was feeling every emotion there was all at the same time. I was happy for them. I was glad the Germans were gone. I was glad that that they didn't get the bomb. I was sad that the Americans used the bomb. The people, and I'm not going to mention any names, a lot of these people end up disappearing or dying, or they suffer losses in family members. But you literally threw everything into this story, and it just painted a detailed portrait for someone like me. I know the broad strokes of World War II, but I enjoy this book very much, and I certainly encourage everyone to get it because it was just a great read, and I could not put it down until the end. I had to find out where the Germans, how far the Germans were going to get, and it was just absolutely amazing, and I just enjoyed it very much.
I really appreciate it. I work on these things for 3 years or more, and it's lovely to hear that it had its hopefully intended effect. Thank you.
Yeah.
And I would like to say one last thing, because I think it's sort of a kind of way to poignantly end it. Paulsen, the head of Graus, when he was told right before he dropped in by parachute into Norway, the reason why he was being sent. He was one of the few who actually knew.
Right.
He was told by his bosses, you are going to Norway to be a part of this operation because the Germans are building something that could blow up London.
Wow.
And Paulsen's response and feeling that he shared not only to his second in command, but ultimately to his men is, that's probably not true. They're probably just saying that to make sure that we do a good job at whatever they want us to do here in our hometown.
Right.
And I think it's important because, I wrote this book. It's this sort of epic story about stopping the Germans from getting the atomic bomb. But for Paulsen and Helberg and Haugland and Tjelstrup and Ronenberg and Hauglid, Stromshine and the others, they were doing it not for the bomb.
Right.
They were doing it for their country. And they weren't even doing it for their country. They were doing it for their family. They were trying to stop, get the Germans the hell out of Norway and to get their freedom back. And I think, again, it's what is so sort of, for me, very compelling about this. Yes, there was some grand stage stuff about this story. Mm-hmm. But at its heart, it's about these guys,
Yeah.
And they just want, they're patriots and they want their country back.
Right.
And I think that's something that, everyone can identify with, not just World War II and,
yeah,
the atomic bomb.
Yeah, you don't think you can be a hero until some guys with guns come into your area and take over everything you have, and then you're willing to go through anything, sacrifice anything to get your area back, your hometown, your to take care of your family. It's amazing what we're all capable of if we have to, and these men were certainly capable of a lot.
They were, and remember, and like you said, I mean, these were postmen and plumbers and students and engineers and scientists and teachers.
Wow.
Very few of them were military men at the start of the war. And that they achieved all this. And I think there's a lesson in there, and I'll let listeners and and readers hopefully sort of plumb it just as I did writing it.
Excellent. Well, again, Mr. Bascom, thank you very much. Again, this comes out early next month, I believe, May 3rd. Everybody, yep, check it out. The Winter Fortress, The Epic Mission of to Sabotage Hitler's Atomic Bomb by Mr. Neil Bascom. Again, thank you very much. For those of you who get it, whether it's audio or you're going to get it electronically or the good old-fashioned paper copy, it is a riveting read that you will not be able to put down, and you're going to lose a lot of sleep over it, but you're going to enjoy it at the same time. Mr. Bascom, thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.